All right, now joining me via phone from New York is John Dobby, founder and chief investment officer at Astoria Portfolio Advisors. They're an ETF strategist currently overseeing more than $300 million in assets. John, great having you back on the show. You actually have the distinct honor of closing out ETF Prime in 2019, so no pressure.
I'll try and end on a good note then.
And hopefully we can do that with the financial markets. And I guess let's start with a recap of the financial markets in 2019. I actually pulled a few returns from some broad-based ETFs. So if you don't mind, let me run through these real quick. So the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY, that's up about 29% this year. Developed International Stocks, VEA, up over 20%. Emerging market stocks, so something like SCHE, the Schwab Emerging Markets ETF, that's up about 17%. And then looking at bonds, BND, the Vanguard Total Bond Market ETF, is up 9%. Long bonds, TLT, is up over 17%. And then high yield, something like JNK, is up around 14%. I'll also toss in a few alternatives. So gold, IAU, that's up 14%. And broad-based REITs, VNQ, are up 24%. The question I have for you is, as you look back on the markets this year and given those returns, what stands out to you? If you had to sum up the markets in a nutshell, how would you characterize them?
Well, I mean, all the returns you just mentioned for 2019 are, I mean, it's the exact opposite for 2018. I mean, everything didn't work last year, and everything did work this year. So, you know, the flip-flopping from one year to the next, I think, is pretty wild. You know, just the sentiment shifts. I mean, year-to-date, despite those large equity returns, you've got, you know, north of $100 billion of outflows from ETFs and mutual funds in the equity space. So that's pretty interesting. And you know, there's hundreds of billions of inflows into bond funds. You know, look, I think you've had a lot of central banks cutting interest rates. You know, the Fed doing some version of quantitative easing again. ECB also, you know, doing their quantitative easing again. So I think, you know, just the sheer movement of the risk assets, you know, and stocks, you know, just outperforming is really kind of a big move, you know, big change from my perspective. And then, of course, you know, Schwab and TD, you know, the kind of merger announcement, no commission trade. And those are all the things that I would kind of characterize, you know, 2019 for us at Astoria.
John, you bring up a good point in that if you go back to about this time last year, the market was in the midst of, what, a 20% drawdown. And I personally think a decent chunk of investors thought that was it, right? Maybe the bull market was finally coming to an end. But now here we are at all-time record highs on the S&P 500. Everything has worked. And I do wonder how many investors maybe went to cash or they got really conservative after the fourth quarter of last year and perhaps missed this year's returns. What do you think the mindset of investors should be now, maybe in comparison to last year?
Well, I don't think you can time these things, and the people that did call for a recession in Q4 last year and are the same people that, you know, were calling for a recession this summer when, you know, you've had all these, you know, inverted yield curves in Europe. And, you know, at points in time in the U.S. market, we had different parts of the interest rate market where, you know, the curve was inverted. I don't think you can time it, so just kind of diversifying your portfolio should always be a mindset. I do believe principally, and that's what we do at our firm, is, you know, diversifying across factors. You know, I think that's something you want to, you know, have on your radar for 2020. And I have some stats I can give you on how a diversified portfolio of factors would have done versus S&P, despite this, you know, rip-roaring, you know, bull market, which we can go into. But, you know, I think, you know, if you are worried about the market and worried about your portfolio, it's pretty obvious then that you have too much equities in there. So, you know, you need to use more cash, right? Or you need to, you know, have more bonds or include alternatives. So things like gold, like you mentioned. So I would just reiterate to investors that if, you know, you walk in and you saw the market down 2-3% and you were worried, then, you know, it means you're misallocated. I find that, you know, pretty often. You know, look, I think bonds, you know, you've got this lower boundary, right? So, you know, with economic data improving, you know, it just feels as though, you know, rates are kind of rising higher, and we don't know if it'll stay higher, but there's just not much value in owning bonds just because interest rates are so low. And then, you know, I do think, you know, a big call that the whole street seems to be making now is, you know, kind of diversifying away from anyone that just owns, you know, U.S. stocks to diversifying overseas. So that'll be really interesting to see if that plays out in 2020 and the next decade is just, you know, U.S. underperforming international markets, because it's been a decade-long outperformance for U.S. over international. So those are the things we're kind of watching for 2020.
John, as I mentioned, you know, look, as we sit here today, U.S. stocks are at all-time highs. Bond yields are still extremely low historically, though they have come up a little bit recently. But credit spreads are still pretty tight. And you look at 2020, we know that's an election year. So that's on the agenda. There's still this trade war with China, which we don't know exactly how that's going to be resolved. I guess as you look at key investment themes, you mentioned, you know, maybe not being that bullish, obviously, on bonds, perhaps looking internationally. I'm just curious, from a risk perspective, is there anything that really keeps you up at night as you look at markets moving forward?
Good question. I would say a combination of, you know, things like inflation, which everyone kind of believes, you know, is pretty subdued. You know, I think these kind of things that you're seeing, like wage pressures and labor cost rises, you know, that could feed into, you know, higher input costs and, you know, kind of result in, you know, bad earnings, you know, for U.S. stocks. And ultimately, at the end of the day, you know, stocks are pieces of businesses and should be valued based on, you know, cash flow analysis. So, it's funny. We had a terrible year for earnings, but you had this 25% rally in the S&P or whatever the statistic you mentioned earlier. You know, so next year, what's going to happen again, right? What's going to be the rate of change that drives, you know, markets? And, you know, I'm not sure if it's going to be, you know, earnings or if it's going to be, you know, something with China and U.S. elections. My sense, and I don't have a crystal ball, and we don't really invest this way, but if you put a gun to my head, you know, I think there's a fund flow story, right? People are underinvested in stocks, right? I mentioned $100 billion of outflows from equity, mutual funds, and ETFs. But once that kind of levels out and the buying is done, you know, my sense is that the market will start to anticipate, you know, the Trump reelection and how that goes. And, you know, I think you can easily see kind of volatility. And for a capital allocator or somebody that's looking at very, very long time horizons, you know, you've had this incredible run of the U.S. outperforming, you know, international markets and bonds as well, right? So I think, like, if you're not trying to time it, then just start to rotate your portfolio into overseas markets, because you've got, you know, this margin of safety, you've got cushion, and, you know, frankly, the U.S. equity index, right, it's pretty expensive, right? And that's the irony of all this. And I think our product, you know, the ETF, and you know, you're passionate about ETFs as well, you know, it's causing this kind of mismatch in valuations where just people are blindly buying, you know, SPY and VTI, and, you know, they're not doing, like, rigorous research to figure out, you know, is there other pockets of opportunities within the U.S.? And my point is that there are. I mean, there's actually a lot of stocks that, you know, I think are offering a pretty reasonable valuation. But, you know, you got to tilt your portfolio, right? So then that comes up, you know, tracking her, how much risk you want to take, you know, how much career risk you want to take. So I think, you know, you've got to do some due diligence from a portfolio construction, risk management standpoint. But, you know, things like China trade, I mean, we have no edge. We can't really forecast what's going to happen, what's not going to happen, if Trump's going to get reelected. So, you know, our vantage point is just to kind of have, like, a diversified portfolio globally, cross factors, include alternatives, bonds. So that's kind of how we're managing risk.
Okay, John, so let's talk more about that. Again, you are an ETF strategist. You build ETF model portfolios. What are some of the specific ETFs that are on your radar for 2020 as you construct portfolios?
Okay, and, you know, just the full, you know, kind of disclosure, you know, obviously go to our website to see, you know, what we kind of own. And because the ETFs I mentioned are just going to be a small subset, because we're not going to rattle off, you know, 10 ETFs.
Yeah, and I think we should also mention, too, just to add some context, you're not some sort of tactical day trader, right? As you mentioned, you don't claim to have a crystal ball. And so I guess maybe do you want to describe your overall investment framework before we actually get into the specific ETFs?
Sure. So I would say, you know, our firm kind of partners with financial advisors. We're really like a research-oriented firm that builds solutions. We sit down with the advisor. Okay, what is the end client trying to solve for? What are their hopes and dreams, and what are they trying to accomplish in their portfolio? And then we will build a portfolio for the advisor, and then depending on if they want to execute and manage the portfolio, you know, we'll do that as well. So think of us as like an outsourced CIO firm. You know, I would say that, you know, step one is again, like sitting down and, you know, are we looking for growth? Are we looking for income? Kind of what's the time horizon that the end client has, okay? That generally tells us how much stocks we want to put in the portfolio, okay? So step one, just, you know, what is the goal, okay? Find out as much as you can about the end client. Step two is how much risk, you know, do we want to take? Combination of, like, the advisor, you know, on behalf of the end client, because I don't think the end client knows about tracking error, but, you know, step two is just figuring out, like, how much risk are we eventually going to put in the portfolio. So if the advisor tells us, like, look, you've got to really track, you know, an MSCI All Country World Index and a Bloomberg Barclays Aggregate Bond Index pretty tightly, then you're going to be, you know, forced to kind of use some of these low-cost ETFs, you know, maybe do, you know, 75% of it, and then just a little bit of deviation, you know, with things like, you know, factors or alternatives, but just very, very modest, okay? If the advisor says, look, you know, the end client doesn't really care about track and error, you know, you have a little bit more leeway, you know, then we can have a little bit more usage of, you know, factors and alternatives. So that's step two, is like, you know, the risk part. Step three is just, you know, our firm will spend some time figuring out kind of where are we in the economic cycle, you know, are there opportunities in overseas markets? And we've talked a little bit earlier about how, you know, we think overseas markets are a little bit more attractive on a very long time horizon. So step three is just kind of figuring out, you know, where do we want to be overweight, underweight on a modest amount. Step four is just what factors historically work well. You know, one of the biggest stories this year is, you know, QUAL, the iShares Quality ETF. I mean, that took in a lot of assets. It had a lot of performance. And that typically, that factor works well, you know, later in the cycle. So step five would be just kind of loading up our portfolio of ETFs, you know, into a portfolio construction tool, just to ensure, you know, we get the right factor exposure. You know, and then step six would be like just rinse, repeat. You know, are we getting the desired outcome that we want? And then, you know, once the advisor and our firm agrees on the portfolio, then it's about, you know, performance, attribution, managing risk, P&L. You know, final step would be reporting back to the client. So it's a lot of research. It's very rigorous. You know, that's kind of like a broad stroke of how we think about, you know, managing a portfolio.
Yeah, so with that as the backdrop, what are some of the ETFs that are on your radar now?
Okay, and we're going to talk about the ones where, you know, we have a little bit more, you know, tilt in, and we have a little bit more track and error. So we do like international markets. I am worried a little bit that, you know, the entire 2020 Wall Street Outlook reports are saying the same thing as me, which, in fairness to us, I mean, you know, we've been pretty vocal all year that you want to own international markets. So we like the WisdomTree IHDG. It's International High Quality Growth Stocks. So it's a quantitative screen. 50% of it is high-quality stocks, so companies with above-average return on equity and return on assets. And the other 50% are just based on a quality growth screen. The ETF does hedge out the currency risk. So it's had good performance this year. What I would say is, you know, the P.E. ratio now is about 17. You know, if you started in January, you looked at it, you know, it was about 12. You know, the issue we have with just buying, let's say, the IEFA or the EFA, which is the broad-based MSCI International Developed Market ETF, is that, you know, that ultimately comes down to, like, a value play and just, you know, a lot of European and Japanese banks. And I don't know if that's really – I mean, that trade hasn't worked in a while. It's been a very tough strategy. So we like quality as a factor. It's kind of robust, persistent. So, yeah, so IHDG is one. We've liked emerging markets a lot this year as well. I mean, China is doing a lot to kind of stimulate their economy. You know, so I would put MCHI in the kind of international bucket as well. For broad-based emerging markets, we use the EDIV, the Spiders Emerging Market Dividend Grower ETFs. We kind of like that one to play, you know, just the broad kind of emerging market equity dividend growth space. So those are a few that we use kind of for our international exposure. And then lastly, I'll mention, you know, U.S. value. You know, so a lot of people are, you know, kind of making this call for value. You know, we've liked it for some time. You know, we're using two different instruments for that, the IVE and the QVAL. IV is a little bit more kind of benchmark constrained, where you're going to have less tracking error. QVAL is a more highly concentrated portfolio. They both use different metrics for how they identify value. And just to tie into to the point I mentioned earlier, you know, the broad S&P is pretty expensive, I would say. You know, we're at 17, 18 times earnings, whereas, you know, things like value trade at, you know, 10, 11, 12 times earnings. So that's, and just to be clear, you know, we're not putting, you know, 20% of the portfolio in, you know, a value ETF, right? This is a slight tweak on the margin on top of like a core holding if we're mandated to keep tracking our low.
John, going back to IHDG, the WisdomTree International Hedged Quality Dividend ETF, why the currency hedge? And I guess I'll combine that with another question, that when you look at emerging markets, you mentioned EDIV, a lot of people would make the case that emerging markets are basically tied to the dollar, that a weaker dollar is good for emerging markets. So how do you sort of reconcile those two, hedging the developed international exposure, but then also being bullish on emerging markets?
Yeah, so usually in emerging markets, the FX and the equity are highly correlated. So usually when the equity does well, the FX, you know, do well. You know, the cost to hedge emerging markets are pretty expensive. If you look at, like, the interest rate markets for, you know, things like Russia, Brazil, you know, they are part of the benchmark. So, again, you know, we have to own some of it because, mm-hmm. You know, it is part of a benchmark. But the way we try and outperform the benchmark is, instead of owning like 5-6% of EEM, which is like the benchmark weight, let's say, for a 60-40 portfolio, we're going to own 5-6% of the EDIV and hope that the quantitative filter, you know, and the screening process of EDIV kind of outperforms. And it has on a risk-adjusted basis over the last couple of years. I would say on the IHDG, you know, the correlation is a little bit less between the equity and FX and developed markets. So it's a good question, and, you know, we struggled with that too, but, you know, ultimately we just felt like in EM, you want to be long the currency and the equity, whereas in developed markets, that correlation isn't as strong, so we'd rather hedge out the FX risks. If you think about it, like, last thing I'll say on this topic is, you know, long-term expected returns for the FX developed markets are pretty low, but they carry volatility, so why own an asset that's not going to give you a return when it owns, you know, when there's inherent volatility? So we just rather hedge it out and not make a bet on the currency.
John, one other quick question on the ETFs. Anything on the alternative side? So I think that's going to be an interesting space to watch as we head to 2020. If investors do think perhaps the U.S. bull market is a little long in the tooth, I think alternative ETFs could, you know, sort of come to the forefront. Anything specific on that alternative side as it pertains to ETFs?
So we do have a couple of solutions. You know, I always wanted the alternative ETF space to grow in terms of assets and products, but it's just been very difficult. And I think that's mainly because you've just had this, you know, massive 400% rally in the U.S. index you know, market over the last, you know, 10 years. But, you know, in theory, you know, I think things like merger arbitrage, which have very low correlation to stocks, things like gold, you know, gold equities, you know, inversely correlated. There's one particular solution, BTAL, which is a long short market neutral, you know, beta ETF, which has like negative 70% correlation to the S&P. So, you know, that one will go up when you've got this big downturn in the market. So that did very well in Q4. I think it was up like 15%. You know, when the S&P was down 25% in Q4 of last year. So things like that, I think, you know, as long as you can find an alternative that, you know, kind of is actually inversely correlated with your stock position, then I think it merits. But, you know, fortunately, the alternative ETFs never kind of got, you know, hundreds of billions of assets like, you know, like some other major category. But I'd hope they do, because I do think they'd serve a valuable place in a portfolio for certain clients.
John, lastly, before I let you go, we spent a lot of time earlier in the podcast discussing ETFs in 2020 and beyond. However, one area we didn't touch on is this topic of model ETF portfolios, which I've seen mentioned quite a bit as a potential significant growth engine for ETFs, right? So the question for you is, how do you see this space playing out over, let's say, the next 5, to 10 years? Because it does seem like a lot of the larger ETF issuers are now offering their own ETF models. Obviously, there are independent providers such as yourself. Just how do you see this space evolving moving forward, and how could that impact ETF growth?
So, you know, it is getting harder, I would say. I think you have to develop like a niche, like of how you are kind of offering your solution. And what we've done differently is, you know, as I mentioned, is, you know, using things like factors and using things like alternatives to hedge. You know, I think at the end of the day, every asset manager will get into this space. But, you know, my problem, if I'm going to be frank, is that if you're buying a 100% ETF model portfolio from one asset manager that happens to have an extensive ETF offering, like how much of like a due diligence, you know, test or is that person passing by just offering 100% just, you know, Spiders or State Street or Vanguard ETFs? It just seems like as a due diligence, you know, when you're in a fiduciary world, you know, you have a fiduciary responsibility to provide, you know, the best solution, the best product. And, you know, I just really think it's really difficult to say, okay, you know, one asset manager, you know, exclusively use their ETFs. I mean, between myself and my partners, I mean, we have extensive experience, you know, in the ETF space, you know, developing solutions, you know, analyzing risk, analyzing the performance. So that's one thing I would caveat, because we kind of get this like, oh, you know, you're competing against 800-pound gorillas that are now offering their own model portfolios. So look, I think it grows because you've got, you know, I think, you know, I eventually envision, you know, you go on like Amazon and Google and Alibaba, and, you know, they'll have some wealth management solution. And, you know, our firm has seen kind of interest from overseas investors. So I think overseas adoption will be pretty big. You know, I think what I would say is just continuing to develop more technology, you know, more financial planning software, taxes into kind of model portfolio solutions. I think that'll be big too, because it's one thing just to say, okay, I'm some smart big asset manager and I've got a great model. But, you know, when you can integrate, you know, the end client's, you know, financial goals and tax lots and what they're trying to solve for with their hopes and dreams, you know, I think that all-encompassing solution, you know, will be pretty big. And I'm not sure if the, you know, if an asset manager is best to solve for that, or if it's some, you know, fintech software company that can build that out. So those are kind of a couple ideas that I would think could happen to the ETF model portfolio space.
No, I agree. I think that's going to be a fascinating segment to watch. And I agree with you that if you look at the larger asset managers who are offering these models, there are some embedded conflicts of interest. And, you know, as these models proliferate and they're available in more places, I think that'll be a topic that comes to the forefront. John, we're going to have to leave it there. Happy holidays to you and your family. I think 2020 should no doubt be a very interesting year. We'll certainly have to check in with you to see how everything is going at Astoria. But thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much.
That was John Davi, founder and chief investment officer at Astoria Portfolio Advisors.